How was the Easter dinner?
It was really good, honestly.
Yeah.
Breaking news to anyone listening who isn't like kin, I am dating somebody. With Easter was kind of weird this year on the Enfield side of things,
it just got blowed up basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone kind of like,
yep,
had their own things going on. And so me and my folks went over to, do Easter with my girlfriend's family, and it was awesome, man. It was a really, really great afternoon and evening.
Nice.
It was awesome.
What was the food?
Did not go swimming, so like that was a little bit of a letdown.
That
but like, I wasn't that upset about it, if I'm honest.
True.
On a cold, rainy Easter Sunday,
it was like, cold.
Yeah, it would have definitely been one of those days where like I'm trying to recreate Jesus walking on water, like see if I can launch myself like a skipping stone across the top of the pool. The food was incredible. They did like a salmon pasta thing.
Oh crap.
With like asparagus, and her mom made this like halal bread. And her sister brought these, I can't remember what they're called now. Pavlovas.
Oh,
which is basically,
I just made pavlova for the girls like a little bit ago.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's meringue. So like whipped marshmallow,
basically.
And then some frosting and some fruit. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh yeah, no. This is phenomenal. I love all of this.
Yeah.
So like food wise, it was really good. And it was also really cool just sort of how, naturally like our folks kind of mingled together and,
oh, that's good.
You know, her mom is a lot like, my mom in terms of like, there is not a stranger that exists on planet Earth. There's just people who don't know they love her yet.
Yep.
And so like, and then, it was a really good time. Good. How about your Easter? What did you guys end up doing?
Yeah, it was good. Everybody came out to the house. My family came out to my house. We didn't have the pool filled, so there was no jumping in on Easter. It's just a big hole in the ground still. So next year, though, I think next year I'm going to tell everybody that I'll take it over, and we can be the Easter spot going forward. But I smoked pork loin.
Mm.
So it was, tried to hold that tradition, you know, at least. And it was pretty good. It's pretty solid. It's hard to mess up a pork loin, you know, like you just,
I mean, kind of like I don't know, man. Pork is one of those meats. Like I love pork, but like if it came out well, good on you, because like it's one of those things, white meat, man, since you've got to cook it through, like you can't do like you don't want your pork pink.
Yes and no, but yeah, okay. I know what you mean, but like
you don't have as much leeway like undercooking it.
Correct.
As you do,
yeah, it's
some
not like
things.
beef yeah, right. You can literally eat raw
as long as I've got a good sear on the outside. Yeah. We'll be fine.
Yeah.
Everything after that is just preference.
Yeah, you can't do that
unless you want it well done, in which case you're just wrong.
Then yeah.
And it's no longer a matter of preference.
Yep.
But like, yeah, pork can dry out.
Correct.
Not as easily as chicken can.
Correct.
But so like, that's awesome.
Yeah. So that's something that I've been learning is time and temperature, like managing that. So like, again, cooking chicken, like you don't have to cook chicken to 165.
Right. Cause it'll keep cooking after you pull it.
Well, yeah, but I'm like, you can stop it at 150. As long as you hold it at 150 for a certain amount of time, then it kills everything. Like you get it to 165, everything is dead instantly. Dry chicken, stringy, sucks, right? It just carries the barbecue sauce. Mm. But like I've been figuring out.
It just
out
carries how to, the barbecue sauce. Yeah. I like that.
And figuring out how to cook this stuff at a way that doesn't dry out like that. So hopefully, hopefully it won't be a disappointment, because Uncle Randy had it pretty dialed in there for a little while.
I was going to ask, did you, Did you stick with what he told you and it's just salt and pepper for the rub or?
Oh, goodness, no. No, that's nonsense.
Yeah, no, obviously.
Okay, all right. I'm sure everybody's tired of hearing us talk about food, but for our food podcast today, all right. Hitting an intro.
Welcome to the podcast, Blue Collar Scholars. Not long ago, a group of brilliant minds met together at a pub to discuss their unfinished works. They recognized the value of coming together around delicious beverages and having meaningful conversations. That group was known as the Inklings. The Inkledoo podcast here, we're working to be the second iteration of that group. So pour yourself a craft beverage, pull up a chair, and join the conversation.
All right. Did you have anything interesting to drink at Easter or around?
Yeah, no. To pair with the pasta and the salmon, had a white wine that was really nice. It was called, I had it like literally 2 minutes ago. But it was a nice white wine. It was one of those things. So like their family gathering is a lot smaller than ours are used to. Mm. So like it's not necessarily totally potluck style. It's a lot more like the hosts kind of take care of things. And gotcha. So that was my folks' contribution was they stopped by, told the wonderful service staff not a paid advertisement unless they want to offer us some at Total Wine. Like, hey, here's what we're having. They recommended a couple bottles of white, and yeah, they knew what they were talking about, which is not uncommon.
Nice.
No, total so it did. It good. Paired really well. It was nice. It was good. I mean, I'm still not.
Do you remember what it was? Was it a Riesling, a Grigio,
I think it was
Chardonnay.
I think it was like a Pinot Blanc or something like that.
Okay.
And it was. It was definitely not a sweet white wine.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was, you know, almost a. It was probably more to the dry side of the whites, but yeah, it was good, man. It did the job, absolutely.
Nice, yeah. Venturing into those things that like you, it's so much easier when you can pair it with food. You know,
absolutely.
Like if it's something you enjoy sitting and drinking it is easy, but if it's not something that you're familiar with or you know or you like you're learning it, sometimes just having it with something like when I was learning coffee, like I didn't like it at all, but then somebody gave me a brownie and then told me to drink the coffee and I was like, "Holy crap, it tastes totally different, you know. It's actually good." And then it kind of breaks open your brain and then you can start to pick it out more.
It can accent some of the flavors when you've got something similar to kind of pair it with. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to reach back into my last one for Santa because we didn't have much for the for Easter because it was just kind of a little thing. So we didn't.
Sure.
The only thing we had was one of my nephews really likes our like these punches that Kristen makes where it's like
punch
with ice cream and soda type of a thing. So she makes one for Christmas. She made one for Easter. And
she does like the Grinch drip juice or whatever.
Yeah.
Like
now this one was, Easter punch and he was all about it. So she's like, well, I'll keep making it for him. Like he's going to be like 35 and Aunt's still going to be making him like, you know, Grinch punch. But oh, well,
sweet gig if you can get it, man.
I know. Right. But we were in San Diego and I took everybody to a barbecue place and I got a beer from Mammoth Brewing.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is interesting. It's a double nut brown.
Oh
yeah.
Okay.
You don't know. I was like, that's super interesting. Cause you don't normally see doubles in browns, right? Like they're not meant to be that way usually. And so I was like, okay, let's try it. But I actually really, really liked it because I like browns and ambers and all that stuff that goes with barbecue really well. Same reason why you go with a porter. Like porters and stouts, or stouts more so, with barbecue because they compete, you know? And so that's kind of what the double did. You made it a little bit boozy and it held its own and it kind of contributed to the barbecue and not just like added more malty sweet brown flavors to your barbecue plate. So it was
so it kept it from being like cloyingly sweet.
Yeah, it was really good, and I was just super surprised to find it. And yeah, it was, because it was cool. This little barbecue shop was, it was a little tiny stand, and then they just had like three or four coolers like on the side, and you got it by the can. Yeah. So you could have gotten like three or four different things, but it was California, and it, you know, I would have gone broke. So I searched it, and that was the one I landed on. It was. Have you had anything from Mammoth Brewing before? I think they're
kind of. I have. I don't remember what.
I was going to say, that's kind of big, like, right? Or regionally.
They're definitely
big.
One that I've seen enough times that I know I've grabbed some of their things out of coolers before.
Yeah.
But I genuinely cannot at the moment remember what ones.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never had anything from them, but I knew the name.
Yeah.
Type of a, you know. So yeah. It's been nice to have something interesting to talk about, for sure, from the drink front, you know?
Yeah.
But very cool. So I guess we're post Easter now.
We are. We're recording on April Fool's Day.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had not posting on April Fool's Day, so it doesn't make sense to turn this into a joke episode.
To make any sort of joke, yeah. I always, people try to get me in on April Fool's jokes. I'm so bad at them. Like, I'm really bad, but like, don't get me involved. Like, I'm not. I just shouldn't do it. But my kids,
I've just seen
doing
so
it.
Very few that are actually like funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the truth. My kids were devastated because they've been playing April Fool's jokes on their one grandma since they were born, basically. And this is the first time that they're both in school, so grandmas don't come over, you know, on the days.
Oh,
so
yeah.
They were very sad they didn't get to play a trick on grandma. And they've gotten her pretty good sometime. Like, out of like the four or five that they've done, there's been a couple that were solid.
Nice.
But reflecting on the Easter bit, I felt bad saying bit, like it was a SNL skit or something, but that's not at all what I intended, but I overthought my words while I was in the middle of speaking, so I figured I should just lay it out there. And it's interesting how, you know, when you're kind of looking at Jesus, the way you almost have to go back to Adam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we've touched on a lot of this stuff before, but you brought it up, and I thought it was super interesting and kind of not compare and contrast, but it's kind of like start and finish almost more than compare and contrast. And so there, you had some really good points on, you know, Adam started this way, ended that way. Jesus started this way, ended that way, and then kind of comparing them. Do you want to kind of jump into them?
Sure. I mean, you know, like, you're right, first of all, that it's the only way it really makes sense. Like, you can't think of Jesus disconnected from the story of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, because the crucifixion doesn't make sense, like, isn't necessary without the fall, without that first sin that's committed, you know? And right away in Genesis, we get that, what they call the proto-evangelium, the first good news, the first proclamation of the gospel, when God promises, even as they're being banished from Eden, he promises that the serpent will strike at the heels of the child of the woman, but that the child of the woman will strike at the serpent's head. Mm-hmm. Like this battle whose fate is already decided is coming. And then that is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
But like, when we look at it, I think also in the context of a lot of the things we were talking about during Lent, with that idea of things being properly ordered. Because that's ultimately where it all falls apart, is that we've got everything is good in the Garden of Eden. In fact, God goes so far as to say at the end of the sixth day, it is very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things are really, really good. But because of the choices of Adam and Eve, that order is lost and chaos enters.
Can I interrupt really quick?
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I got stuck on another word. Do you think, again, you know, maybe it'd be a Bible scholar question, but like, do you think there's a reason for using the word good and not perfect?
I do. Like, I mean, this is absolutely just speculation on my part.
Okay.
But like, ultimately, the Garden of Eden and we've talked about this before too, it's not heaven. Like what we have access to now through Christ with that opportunity for life perpetually in the beatific vision in heaven is better than what we lost in Eden. Like,
okay.
Adam and Eve are able to walk with God in the garden. Like walk side by side and talk with him. And that's incredible because that's not an experience that most of us would describe as part of our daily lives.
Right.
However, there are still times where they are not fully and completely in the presence of God. Obviously, because it talks about God coming into the garden and Adam and Eve hear him coming and they hide. It's not that they're disconnected from God or that God's not there in some sense, but his full presence is not with them. In that same way.
Oh,
whereas in heaven,
okay,
we are entirely in the presence of God.
In the full presence. Okay, that makes sense to me now. So it's kind of like an in part with a fullness to come, but then somebody went up and grabbed the steering wheel and we crashed into a pole.
Yes.
And then
essentially
we took the long way around to that fullness.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think, so there's also, like, linguistically, I don't know linguistically, I know, like, they didn't actually have a word in the Hebrew language for very.
Mm.
So, like, they would describe things, if they wanted to say it was very good, they would just use the word for good twice. And if they wanted to say it was, like, perfectly good, the definition of good, they would say good three times. But that description of goodness is only ever directed to God in the Bible as well. So like there's that part of it, which I think still kind of supports my idea that it's
sure. That, yeah. That makes
God
sense.
God was not perfectly with them in the garden. But yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted your thought.
Oh, no, not at all.
Didn't derail it too much.
No, not at all. Okay. And so like, but again, it is very good. And they do have, first and foremost, that incredibly close relationship with God. This incredible covenant based in, like, just pure gift. And, like, literally, the only requirement put on them was, there is one thing that I am not giving you of all that's in here. Just don't take that.
Mm.
You know, when you look at the other covenants, like with Abraham having to leave his family behind, when you look at Noah having to build the ark and save the animals and stay on the boat for 40 plus days, when you look at Moses and having to put up with the Israelites in the desert for 40 years, like there's all these like heavy kind of prices that are asked of the people in the covenant. Not heavy compared to the gifts that God is giving them. Like, it's still an easy win for them in the deal. But, like, this first covenant is, like, legitimately, hey, I'm giving you everything except this. Don't take that. Oh, okay, cool.
I never considered that a covenant. Like, I never once thought about the situation in Eden to be a covenant relationship.
Well, because there are, like, promises from God in it. You know, he promises that, like, they will... you know, kind of an implied promise of everlasting life when he says, if you eat of that, you will die. Mm-hmm. There is the implied promise that as long as you don't eat of that, you won't.
Yeah.
Okay. There is the promise of having everything else that's in there being given to them and all that. So yeah, but they've got this incredible close relationship with God, which goes away because Adam and Eve choose knowledge over life. Like, interestingly, that's what it comes down to. In the garden, one of the trees that they had access to was the tree of life. And the tree they weren't supposed to have access to was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. In choosing the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they lost that tree of life.
Hmm.
And so their relationship... their relationships in general are damaged.
I'm just going to like ponder on that. Like this is probably something that everybody's thought about already, but like just on that fruit again, like of good and evil, that means like you know good and you just had to experience evil so that you could be enlightened to it. So that you didn't gain any, like there was nothing more than like you already knew half of the good and evil side. You just didn't realize it until you broke the rule and the epiphany was there. Like,
yeah.
And then like, you would have been just like, what a sucky deal. I already knew all of this. Why did I?
Right. Like, and that's all, that's kind of not always, but for like a few years now, that's kind of been how I've thought of it is like, wait a minute, but they were already walking with God. They knew God as a friend.
Yeah.
God is good. Like when we say something is good, like it is godly. If something is actually good, it points to God.
Yep.
They actually knew God. Like, again, walked with him in the garden. And so they already knew that. And all they gained was evil.
Yeah.
Man.
Oh, again, sorry I derailed your thought.
No, not at all. Because that's actually exactly where I'm going in terms of what... That's the implication on all these relationships. Like, their relationship with God. You know, even before they eat the fruit, just in choosing to listen to the serpent and to take the fruit, they have already begun to doubt God. And so that relationship is already being damaged or already being weakened even before they commit that final act of consuming what they were told not to. Their relationship with each other. They now are able to see each other with evil desires and to recognize that the other person is seeing them with evil desires. Mm-hmm. So their trust with one another is gone. And now they need clothing to hide themselves. Their relationship with nature. It says that like before he removes them from the Garden of Eden, God fashions clothing for them from the skin of some of the animals in the garden. Mm-hmm. So while they had been able to just get everything they needed without having to kill or destroy nature in any way, now that's not an option. Like now there is competition in their relationship with nature that wasn't necessary there. And because evil is like a lack, a darkening of the intellect, like they don't even know themselves fully anymore. They can't trust their own judgments on things the way they could before. And so all of this disorder is brought in through their disobedience. All of this chaos enters in and has been the story of human history.
Yeah. I like that. The man versus God, man versus man versus nature, man versus self. Like,
yeah, it's
that's that, like, if you think about all of the different ways that you get screwed up, you're like, yeah, that is pretty much every single one of them. That sums it up. Like, I don't think there's an evil that falls outside of that.
And the other thing that I really like about it is that it really points out that all of them are relational. Like, and this is part of why even really good men afterwards, Noah, Abraham, Joseph, David, they still couldn't actually fix it. Because the damage is beyond one person. It's relational. And so what it takes is the actions of the infinite. But it can't just be the actions of the infinite. Because again, where did the harm come from? It came from the finite. It came from the creature. It came from man. And so man has to be part of the solution as well. And God makes this really clear, again, in that proto-evangelium. It will be a son born of woman who will crush the head of the serpent, who will ultimately right this wrong of a fall. And so we get Christ coming down, and whereas Adam broke faith with God, he was disobedient, and then sought to make excuses for it, to point the blame at others for his failure. Jesus instead not only does the will of the Father, but actively seeks it out. Like throughout the Gospels, Jesus takes time away to go and pray, to go and seek time talking to his Father. Right before the crucifixion on Holy Thursday into Good Friday, he's out praying you know, like, look, if there's another way, please, but not my will, your will be done.
Mm-hmm.
And when he sees them coming to arrest them, he trusts in the will of the Father, doesn't resist, slaps Peter's wrist a little bit when Peter tries to resist on his behalf, and then accepts what the Lord has called him to do, what his Father has sent him for.
Yeah, it's an interesting change in dynamic, right? Where Adam chooses, Adam and Eve choose self, right? Like what I will gain from this. I will do this thing and I will get this thing from doing it. Jesus kind of does the opposite, kind of negates it by not choosing the self, by choosing the Father and ultimately sacrificing the self, you know, himself. And so it's, you almost have, you know, like, again, negating features there where one chooses self, one chooses self-sacrifice.
And the one who chooses self ultimately loses self. Whereas the one who sacrifices himself gains himself, like in full glory. And all these things beside it, you know, like all of creation is redeemed through his act.
Yeah.
And so, like, because Jesus actively seeks out the will of his Father, you know, we get that same idea as well. Going back to that idea of the two trees, Jesus has no desire for the tree of knowledge, you know, for a couple of reasons. You know, for one thing, Jesus, divine.
Yeah, he's good.
There's no knowledge to be gained.
Yeah.
Like, he knows it all. But in his humanity... So even as it says in Luke that, like, Jesus grew in wisdom and understanding as he was growing, he does that by going to God.
Yeah.
Adam and Eve, it's not just that they sought knowledge. It's that they sought knowledge apart from God.
Right. Right. There's a trust in God that, because Jesus admits that he does not know the final time. You know, like, there's all the question that he did not know everything, but he never doubts. He never felt. The trust was so there that he never felt that he was without anything that he might need.
Exactly. Right?
And so Adam and Eve felt this lack from temptation, and so then they went to go try to fill it themselves, whereas Jesus had the perfect trust and did not feel the need to seek to self-satisfy.
Exactly. And, like, through that, Jesus... Man, like... On the cross, Jesus makes this dead wood, which is also a wood of death.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, it's wood that was killed so that people could be killed on it. Like, and Jesus turns it into the tree of life.
Yeah.
Like that all who eat the fruit of this tree might live and not die.
Yeah. I like that. Man, when you laid that out, I was like,
freaking nuts.
That's cool. Like, that's, I'd not thought about the cross becoming like the new tree of life, essentially, you know, like that. Yeah. I was like, wow, that one, that was new for me. I liked it. And I like it a lot. I think that's, so it's kind of like you said, a new tree of life. It's,
And like, because of this, when we look at the life of Jesus, when, you know, when we see all of the chaos and all of the disorder that Adam and Eve bring in through their sin, through their insistence on this sort of false independence from God, in this attempt to insist on doing things on their own, which, again, like, it's not really funny. But since we know the end of the story, we can kind of laugh on it as a little bit of dark humor, the way it worked out. But, like, they didn't become more independent. Like, they sought to do things without God and found themselves enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they lost the ability to do things rather than gaining the ability to do things.
Yeah.
And so then Christ comes in, this new Adam that St. Paul talks about. And man and God are united.
Mm-hmm.
And so Christ is both finite in his humanity and infinite in his divinity. And so as the finite creature, man serves God. Mm-hmm. Like the flesh of Christ dedicates itself to doing the will of the Father who sent him. And he teaches man to serve God once again. He teaches man to forgive man. Mm-hmm. His conversation with Peter out on the shore, you know, with the "Do you love me?" three times. And again, like, I love Peter so much, man.
Yeah.
Like, because I would have probably handled things similarly.
Yep.
Both on the upside, like, as soon as he realizes it's Jesus, screw this boat, I'm swimming.
Yep.
Like, jumps out and goes.
Yeah.
But also, like, I would have been as short-term memory about just how badly I had screwed things up before. Mm-hmm. That when Jesus had the audacity to ask me three times if I loved him, I would be like, dude, I've already told you. Yeah, but you remember that part where, like, no, I'm asking you three times for your sake, because you denied me three times, now you get to affirm me three times. Like, mm-hmm. it's, trust me, this is working. I would have needed that too.
Yep.
But, like, he brings that forgiveness and teaches us to forgive. 70 times 7. The relationship between man and nature. Like, look, obviously that's still a work in progress. Like, that's not one that we'll see fully realized, but we're promised it. That new heavens and the new earth. Where, once again, there won't be competition between man and nature.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, with man and self, we are never more ourselves, and we never understand ourselves more than when we are being reflected, when we are reflecting God by being in his presence.
Right.
And so, like, that opportunity to be in heaven, in that vision with God, man, all of the damage that was done, Jesus not only undoes, and that's where I love what you said at the beginning. It's not about just, like, fixing these things. It's about, like, no, look, there was, even from the garden, there was work to be done, even if you hadn't made a mess.
Right.
I'm still going to get you here.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it. Yeah, that's actually one of my, I'm preparing for, I teach a class on theology this month at my church, and I'm reading through my notes. And one of my favorite sections is, like, the logos, right? And how the logos, they use the Greek term, the cosmic mediator, right, between God and man. And so it's fully God. And then you have his humanity, which makes him fully human. And you're like, oh, you need all of these things to come together in place to become the new fountainhead, right? And so, like, the fountainhead of humanity is one of those images that I really like. So how Adam became the fountainhead for was the first fountainhead for humanity, and so which all sin and death flows to us from him, and then Christ becomes the new, we're recapitulated, right? So we have a new head, a new fountainhead, in which life flows down to us through him, and all of those different things come into play. And so I've been chewing on this, and so, you know, seeing the different, again, not compare and contrast, but like how the two things work together, the way that God, when God writes stories, he foreshadows perfectly and lovely. And so when you see these connections and how they're all interwoven together, it's just a masterful story, and it brings more hope, more, because it's intentional. Like, you see God working in that, you know? And so I guess if I'm wrapping up into a quick life lesson, that's kind of it for me, is seeing the intentionality of God in the universe, right? Like, seeing that he finishes what he starts, and he never leaves us, never forsakes us. What he began, he finishes, right? And so I know that I'm unfinished, and so it's good news that he's not done yet, right? Like, and he doesn't quit. So that's the hopeful part, is I know he's not going to be like, I'm tired of this dude, I'm out, you know?
Yeah.
So
he's not going to rage quit on you.
Right. for as many reasons as I've given him.
Yeah. He just never does. It's amazing. Yeah, man. I love that. I think in kind of a similar vein, for me, it's that idea that, you know, Adam had this colossal mistake, and then I can look at human history from then on and see this litany of mistakes and messes and things that have happened, and all of the times where humanity, either as individuals or as collectives, has chosen evil and continues to, like, even after Christ was here, and like still know that, not that it doesn't matter, because it definitely does. Mm-hmm. Like, those are all horrible things, and we need to be striving to do better, but none of them have derailed what God intends. Like, the finish line remains the finish line, regardless of what happens mm-hmm. along this race. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at my own life and the litany of mistakes that I have made, the times where I have, like Adam, chosen myself, like Adam, chosen my false sense of independence, like Adam, chosen not to trust in the Lord. Yeah, those suck. Mm-hmm. And I need to try and do better. But it's not a game ender.
Right.
Like,
right.
The finish line remains the finish line. And as long as I keep running the race, I will run so as to win.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as you don't sit down and quit,
mm-hmm.
you'll get across the finish line. I like it. I love Easter.
It's so great, man.
It is good. It's rich, man. It is so rich. Very cool. You got anything else on your brain there, man?
Oh, a million things, but yeah. No, I'm good.
Right on, right on. All right. With that, everybody, we will say
adieu.